totally agree.
Okay. Morning, everyone. The Sanity 12 committee will come to order. Today is Wednesday, March 25, 2015. It's 8:30 a.m. We're in room 112 of the state capitol. We have a plethora of bills before us today. We're going to start with Senate File 1364, Senator Kent, and we do have distributed an A2 amendment whenever you'd like to offer that. Thank you, Senator Kent, and welcome to all of your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we can get to the A2 amendment in a little while. I'll go ahead and get started talking about this bill. I am truly pleased to introduce Senate File 1364 to you this morning. The Student Support Services Personnel Act represents tremendous effort and partnership by many people who are dedicated to the well-being and success of Minnesota students. And this effort, I would submit, delivers a creative yet common-sense solution to a very long-standing challenge in Minnesota schools. So first, I want to offer a quick clarification and definition of terms and an important bit of context. This bill is often referred to in shorthand as the counselor's bill. This is understandable because the longstanding shortage of counselors, the fact that Minnesota ranks 48th in the nation in the ratio of counselors to students, is well documented, well understood, and very troubling. In addition, the multifaceted nature of counselors' training and job description addresses a wide range of student needs: academic, career, personal, social, and mental health. But as Senate File 1364 defines in Section 2, these student needs are ultimately met by a team of professionals in our schools. The Student Support Services personnel team includes licensed school counselors, school psychologists, school nurses, school social workers, and chemical dependency counselors. So why do these professionals matter? What difference do they make to our kids? On first thought, of course school nurses matter. We've all gotten that call from the nurse's office that sends us rushing to school to pick up a sick kid. Of course, all these professionals are there to help kids. But I want to take some time to explore the many ways that these professionals really make a difference in students' immediate well-being and lifelong success. I want to begin by reminding everyone about the statutory framework of the world's best workforce. We created this, and we, along with our local schools and the Department of Education, are building on this framework to help all Minnesota students succeed. Senate File 1364 will provide critical support in achieving four of the five goals of the world's best workforce, all the ones that happen once kids are in school. Third grade literacy, closing the achievement gaps, all students are ready for career in college, all students graduate from high school. So how do these professionals do all that? Let's start by thinking about the bills we've heard in this committee just this session and the testimony about the ways we can help students succeed. Senator Johnson reminds us that there are non-academic barriers to student success, and we've had powerful testimony about the reality of hunger for many of our kids. Just think, how many of those cases are first discovered by nurses when a young child says she has a tummy ache? How many vision problems identified by a nurse's screening that, when corrected early, allow a student to reach that critical milestone of third grade literacy? Remember the discussion on Senator Hoffman's bill regarding student suspensions. Think about how students' social, behavioral, or mental health needs and challenges affect not only them, but the other students in a class. Making sure that teachers and principals have the right trained professionals available helps all students. I think about the presentation by Isaiah here a few weeks ago. I vividly recall the social worker from St. Cloud who spoke about the increasingly diverse student population there and how students of color were able to respond to professionals of color. We speak often of the need for greater diversity among our teachers. The same is surely true of student services personnel. And finally, the goals of making sure that all our students graduate and that they're college and career ready when they do. Senator Weber's bill yesterday regarding career and technical programs is just the recent of many, including Senator Stumpf's and others, to address the significant mismatch between jobs and skills. With Senator Saxhog's and Senator Bonoff's bills to strengthen the connection between state workforce and DEED efforts, we see the need to change the culture in helping our students and their families appreciate the opportunity in a wide range of careers. But they need that information, that informed counseling to know their options and how to pursue those pathways. Which brings us to a broader view of post-secondary and career planning. We've begun a better approach to identifying earlier on whether a student is on a trajectory to graduate ready to those next stages. The whole point is to have time to identify challenges early enough so that we can intervene. This, plus solid planning for post-secondary in college, means that students can avoid remedial coursework in college, which is expensive, a loss of time, and ultimately seriously frustrating to students' momentum as they embark on this important next step of their lives. Don't we all want for all Minnesota students to have the best information and support so that they can find and achieve their own best pathway? So that's a summary of the needs and the benefits of the Student Support Services Personnel Act. I want to call attention in your packet to a report that was issued by the Department of Education a little over a year ago. Yes, it's the Student Support Services Team Staffing Approach from the fiscal year 2014. And it's worth pointing out that this came out of legislation from 2013, a bill of Senator Johnson's that also would have begun to start addressing the problem of these shortages. That didn't go forward at that time, but it did lead to this report, which has informed a lot of the work that we're doing here. So I want to make sure members are aware of it. I will quickly walk through the details of the bill, how it works, and why we believe this represents a common sense, balanced approach to this significant and long-standing problem. First of all, this would be a grant program aimed at helping local districts with staffing to address the range of student needs I've just described. As a grant program, it is completely optional for a school district to participate. We define the team to include the five types of professionals: counselors, social workers, school psychologists, nurses, and chemical dependency counselors. The grants would apply to new positions, and this would include increasing a part-time position to a full-time position. The grants would be matching funds and would last for a total of 6 years. This way, there's a strong state and local partnership, and we all have skin in the game. Unlike previous efforts, there are no mandated ratios or maintenance of effort. Instead, we're proposing a significant incentive and strong local flexibility. This is achieved by offering the 6-year match, which is 50-50 state and local for the first 4 years, then 25% from the state in the final 2 years, and then it transitions 100% to the local district. There is significant local flexibility in determining which positions of the five best meet the needs of their students and fit in with their current staffing situation. I will also call attention in your packet to this spreadsheet, and it shows how the percentage match works out over 6 years, so that in 7 years there's 0% contribution from the state. And at the bottom it shows basically you would have a class of grantees in year one and then a class of grantees in year two. The exact amounts for each of those years is not necessarily fixed. That's just an estimate. It's going to be a slower uptake in the first year, obviously. But it does max at $23 million in the first biennium, and that's so that this appropriation would cover the entire amount. It is fiscally responsible. We do the appropriation all up front, and it covers all 7 years for these two classes of grantees. And it is also important to note that we estimate that with the combination of the state contribution and the local match, this would result in 750 to 800 new positions around the state of Minnesota. In the middle of page 2 in subdivision 3, beginning on line 2.13, the Commissioner of Education would award the grants based on criteria outlined in the bill, including existing caseloads, school demographics, Title I revenue, Minnesota student survey data to identify the needs, and graduation and post-secondary completion rates. There's a reporting requirement so that we can monitor the success of the grants in the program and inform future efforts. Section 3 provides grants to post-secondary institutions who train professionals in these fields, as there will likely need to be a ramp-up in their capacity. And Section 4 outlines the appropriations for the K-12 and post-secondary grants. In addition, in this section, we recognize that cuts over the years means that the Department of Education has very little capacity to regularly monitor this important aspect of our K-12 system around the state, and we provide a direction for the department to administer and report on these systems, as well as an appropriation for this amount. And that, members, is an overview of Senate File 1364. I particularly want to thank the Minnesota School Counselors Association, the Minnesota School Psychologists Association, the Minnesota School Social Workers Association, and the School Nurses Organization of Minnesota. Their very great efforts and collaboration have been consistent with the same kind of teamwork we see in our schools on behalf of our students. And I have great respect for their dedication and gratitude for how they have partnered to create this solution. And that is the note on which I want to conclude. These shortages around our state, which you will hear more about from our testifiers, have existed for many years, and we haven't figured out a way, either locally or at the state level, to fix this problem. Until now, we hope. We are hopeful that this common-sense, balanced approach, which is fiscally prudent and locally focused, will make significant progress in helping our students succeed. And with that, I would like to turn it over to my testifiers. I'm glad this morning. Can we go ahead and offer the A2 amendment? Do we have our quorum?
We're shy one member for a quorum. We will adopt that when we have
one. Thank you. So with that, we will move on to our testifiers. I would first like to introduce Bill Stock, who has come down here from Thief River Falls.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Stock. I'm a licensed school counselor, as Senator Kent said, from Thief River Falls, which is five long plus hours away. Okay, but I really want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate File 1364. Okay, licensed school counselors are one of the five groups within the Student Support Services personnel targeted for funding with 1364. Each group plays a vital role in assisting our kids at the K-12 levels to be successful both in school and in life after high school. I tell kids and parents all the time, my job is to help you be successful in all aspects of school life, including personal, social development, academic success, career and educational planning for present and the future. I also spend a great deal of time responding to mental health, special needs, and crisis situations as they arise. We support what happens in our classrooms and school environments in all of these areas. Each one of the Student Support Services groups helps students based on their background and training. While there may be some overlap of services in some areas, school counselors are the only ones among the group who have extensive training in career counseling. We deal with the needs of the whole child, particularly when it comes to academic planning, testing, helping kids achieve an understanding of their best fit between interests and abilities, and monitoring the criteria and coursework needed for graduation, which is the goal for every one of our students, obviously. Okay. All of these services assist both the child and the family to make the informed decisions regarding the best post-secondary options which fits their need. Truth to be told, I sometimes spend more time with parents working on these matters as I do kids. Maslow's hierarchy of needs is real in my world every day. Without the basic needs of a child being met, academic success is impossible. I consider our present culture not kid-friendly and not supportive of raising healthy children. That's my experience in the last few years. Okay, I've been in this business for over 40 years. Okay. Sadly, I don't see these changes or these things changing in the immediate future. If we want our schools to be more effective in increasing school safety, reducing the bullying, narrowing the achievement gap among all groups of students, developing and implementing a comprehensive developmental and intentional college career readiness program to meet the world's best workforce goals, and improve mental health services for children, SF 1364 is an avenue to do just that. We have the data that supports our ability to impact these critical areas of concern. So thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'll remain available for questions if necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Stock. We do have a quorum, and Senator Kent moves the A2 author's amendment. All in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Adopted. We have Senate File 1364 as amended. And please proceed, and we have about 13 or so minutes for testimony, and then we'll open it up for a few minutes for questions. This will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to welcome Tina Foyer, who happens to be a school nurse in my school district in South Washington County Schools. It's fun for me to have her here because we first met as PTA parents on a school district committee from different schools in the school district, so it's fun to be here. Thanks.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tina Foyer, and I'm here on behalf of the School Nurse Association of Minnesota, SNOM, to speak in support of Senate File 1364. We'd like to thank Senator Kent for her work on this legislation. I'm a licensed school nurse in Washington County Schools. As one of the student support service professionals that are included as an option in the grant program, I'd like to briefly describe the role of the school nurse. A student's health status is directly related to his or her ability to learn. The number of children with chronic and complex illnesses and special health needs has increased dramatically over the last decade. The school nurse supports students' success by providing health care through assessment, intervention, and follow-up for all children within the school setting. Let me provide you some examples of health issues that I've seen at two of the elementary schools that I oversee, Liberty Ridge and Royal Oaks. Together, these schools serve 1,637 students, pre-K through fifth grade. At Liberty Ridge alone, there are around 476 health conditions. To break just some of these health conditions down, we have 34 students with ADHD, 104 with some type of allergy, 26 with anxiety and OCD, 4 with diabetes, 7 with seizures, and 73 students with asthma. We store approximately 230 different medications, and on average, we see 60 students a day. We work with many different people within the school setting to keep students healthy, stay safe, and in school. And I could speak all morning about the nursing that we do in the schools and could focus, but at this time I just want to focus on just a couple of them. So I'm going to focus on the ones that probably are our biggest, and that's the asthma and the allergies, and that's what tops probably our chronic health conditions that we see the most. 14 million school days are missed each year due to asthma. At the beginning of the school year, we work with bus drivers to let them know which students have health conditions, which could cause an adverse reaction on the bus ride to and from school. We work with the custodians to discuss with them the adverse reactions that could happen with the students as they mow the grass or they put the pesticides out or they're using the cleaning products within the school. We work with the dietitians in the food service area so that we can go over with them the dietary statements and recognize the students with food allergies to help them with the anaphylaxis reactions that could happen with those students. Every year we do an in-service with our teachers and paras, and we go over the EpiPens and the anaphylaxis signs and symptoms, as well as what to do if a child has an anaphylaxis attack in the school. While many of our families have access to primary care, I've still seen confusion with parents about what they really understand when it comes to their child's medications, such as inhalers. I've seen parents send in control inhalers versus their quick relief inhaler just out of confusion or lack of understanding. Most of the time in the schools, we want the quick relief, and I can work with the families and teach the parents the differences, allowing this child to stay in the school and keep the parents from missing work as well. Sometimes parents don't even know we have a nebulizer machine in the health office, and they can keep their children home so that they can use it. And we explain that we have one at school so they can send them in. So again, the child doesn't miss school, and the parents can stay at work. Educating parents and students about their health condition and medications and how we can keep them in the school setting can decrease the absences, which is another area as nurses that we monitor with social workers and our principals to protect against educational neglect. We work with doctors and therapists on medication orders, and we are the liaison between the school and the medical personnel. I hope this provides you with a better understanding of the role of the school nurse, how we, along with other members of the student support team, help to support student success. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1364.
Thank you. And perhaps if remaining testifiers could all join Senator Kent, and if we're not able to get through all of your prepared remarks, please submit them, and perhaps we could focus on salient points and forego thanking the committee and the author, et cetera. We know you appreciate that. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Leafgren. I'm representing the Minnesota School Psychology Association and practicing school psychologist in your district at one point. I am now retired, hence I can be here. So I tell you that I feel already great pride in listening to my colleagues talk about how student support services help students. School psychologists also provide a wide range of services for student success, involving parents, working for academic, mental health reasons, all of the whole child completely. I chose, again, to be brief and to focus on the way school psychologists help teachers, administrators, and parents to look at academic success for children. You know the data. You understand that we are making strides in achievement. You understand that we also have significant gaps. Specifically, there is a huge gap for our African-American students, specifically male, within special education and also within the school system at large. We also know that our American Indian students have significant gaps. I happened to work with the State Department recently on a reducing bias manual, and so that is of particular importance. We are becoming increasingly diverse. When we look at our skills needed to meet current and future workforce requirements, including problem-solving skills, technology literacy, scientific reasoning, and math skills, we see those alarming gaps happening. Services that support and lower barriers to learning provide by interdisciplinary team approach is central to reducing these gaps. Data shows that all students need additional support to achieve. But specifically, in a report of students of color and for American Indian students, we find, again, the disproportional representation of our African-American students, especially our males in EBD. 4 out of 10 students are not proficient in reading. While an increasing proficiency rate has occurred, American Indian, Hispanic Latino, African-American students all scored less than 60% proficient over the last 5 years. Our graduation rate is less than 50%, and frequently these students drop out of school. So how do we help? We are a team. It takes all of us. But specifically, to speak to the role of school psychologists in academic achievement, we help educators and caregivers and families. We identify and remediate barriers to learning. We appropriate research-based academic interventions and monitor the effectiveness of those interventions. We develop students' organizational skills and promote the use of learning strategies. We facilitate effective instruction. As a former teacher and counselor, I know from experience that the help and assistance was of paramount importance in my effectiveness. So school psychologists work with teachers to monitor student progress, evaluate classroom data, adjust interventions and instructional strategies to make content accessible. We support diverse learners, as I have mentioned. We monitor and effectively communicate with parents about student progress. We link to community services. We modify and adapt curriculum and instruction. School psychologists in Minnesota have always been a rare commodity. There's a high need for school psychologists, but there continues to be a lack. According to the most recent job postings on St. Cloud's site, there are 15 positions open for school psychologists at the current time. Positions in greater Minnesota are increasingly more difficult to fill. They include multiple districts, travel, limited scope of practice, and large workload. One school psychologist in greater Minnesota told me of the many hours of windshield time and only being able to get to her schools once every 3 weeks. Another school psychologist reported that her job was so constrained that her job had to be limited to behavior assessments. We are a wise investment of resources. I appreciate your consideration of Senator Kent's bill. I believe that our forces and our support services as united help support our children and our families and our teachers. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Christy McCoy, and I'm a licensed clinical school social worker, and I'm also the current president of the Minnesota School Social Workers Association. And I'm honored to be here today to speak on behalf of Minnesota school social workers across the state of Minnesota. We are here asking you to vote in favor of Senate File 1364 because this bill would provide much-needed resources to school districts that have minimal or no mental health support, specifically in greater Minnesota. Why is this bill important? Mental health is directly related to children's learning and development. Research shows that 1 in 10 youth has serious mental health problems that are severe enough to impair how they function at home, school, or in the community. Yet, only 1 in 5 of these children receives the mental health services they need. According to a report by the U.S. Surgeon General, schools are considered to be a major setting for the potential recognition of early-onset mental health disorders in children and adolescents, which makes sense because children spend a good chunk of their time in the school setting and school staff really get to understand their needs. So in order to effectively address barriers to learning, schools must weave resources into a cohesive and integrated continuum of interventions that promote healthy development and prevent problems, allow for early intervention, and that provides assistance to those with chronic and severe problems. We know that untreated mental health barriers can not only significantly impact a children's educational outcomes, but can also impact the learning environment of other children if not addressed appropriately. When we think about how to effectively address mental health in schools, we need to look at it from an educational model approach, where it is a continuum of services that includes highly qualified school-employed mental health providers like school counselors, school social workers, school nurses, school psychologists, and chemical health counselors, in addition to school-linked mental health providers and community mental health providers. The foundation of a school-based system for supporting the social, emotional, physical, and academic needs of all students is an interdisciplinary team approach, which is comprised of a variety of specialized student support personnel with different backgrounds, perspectives, and training. Access to these school-based mental health services and supports directly improves students' physical and psychological safety, academic performance, and the social-emotional learning, according to a recent study, 2013, by Cohen, Valiant, Rosen, and Pollitt. For example, school social workers, as the mental health professionals and practitioners of the educational team, we are able to provide direct as well as indirect services to students, families, and school personnel using evidence-based interventions and prevention strategies to address the social-emotional barriers that can interfere with learning, such as anxiety, grief and loss, divorce or family changes, and even the impact related to abuse and homelessness. School social workers provide support to students in the regular education setting and to students requiring special education services from preschool through grade 12. So why is MSWA asking you to support Senate File 1364? It's because there is a disparity in the level of accessibility to mental health services across our state. This bill allows for more equitable resources and services for all Minnesota students. I would like to share with you an example of what the current landscape looks like from districts in greater Minnesota. One example comes from Jen Kopp, who is a MSWA board member and school social worker in Heron Lake, Okabena Schools in southwestern Minnesota. Jen's school district currently has 310 students enrolled, but they've reached a high of 400. She has worked for Heron Lake for over 14 years, and in the past 5 years, she has seen a significant increase in the number of students with mental health issues and diagnoses. For example, the number of students in her district who have threatened suicide, developed eating disorders, and/or are cutting has dramatically increased. This year alone, Jen has referred 5 students for inpatient services to Avera Behavioral Health, a hospital-based facility due to the severity of their mental health needs. This is the closest facility of its kind, and it's 90 minutes away. Jen is the only licensed school social worker in her district. Heron Lake Ogabena School District does not have a school counselor. School psychology services are contracted, and the school psychologist is available only one day a week to specifically do special ed evaluations. In addition, there's a part-time school nurse who is contracted for approximately 8 hours a month, so the Heron Lake Ogabena School District covers day-to-day medical issues using volunteer EMTs on staff. Jen, along with three other staff members, are currently volunteer EMTs for their local communities, so if someone becomes hurt, sick, or for instance, when one of the students with epilepsy has a periodic seizure, the volunteer EMTs are the ones who have to address those medical needs. This year, her district was able to get a CTSS mental health worker to provide mental health services, but this individual is only able to see 12 students and has a waiting list for more. In addition, the nearest community mental health provider is about 20 minutes away. This may not seem significantly far, but getting an appointment there can take months, and because the clinic is so overwhelmed, it often has frequent staff turnover. We also know one of the benefits of having school-based mental health supports is that these professionals have established trusting relationships with families. Many families are not comfortable or culturally have a different view of mental health that doesn't always fit the Western medical model approach. One licensed school social worker from Pipestone School District shared, as she has been giving training for school staff on youth mental health first aid, that many districts surrounding Pipestone are sharing the need for additional school-based mental health supports. Many do not have a school social worker or may not have a counselor, and the few that do, those are the only services that those students have. Otherwise, their needs would go unmet. Jen from Ogabena School District has 36 students on her caseload and that she sees weekly and 10 more that she checks in with. Half of her students on her caseload have a mental health diagnosis, and the remaining are exhibiting significant mental health impairment. Many of her families are a Hispanic population, and they don't have very much trust in outside mental health supports. But because of the relationship that has been established by Jen and the school staff with these families seek out Jen's expertise to be able to provide for their students' mental health needs. I'd like to thank you today for allowing me to be here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota School Social Workers Association, and we hope that you will really recognize the essential importance of this bill. It truly is cost-effective, and it provides flexibility for our families by reducing barriers. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kent, I'm going to ask if any remaining testifiers could submit their testimony and, for the record, acknowledge their support for the bill. But we need to move on within the next 5 minutes.
Yes.
Otherwise, we're looking at room availability for Friday right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Those that would like, there's a lot of excellent persuasion on the record as to the need, and we'll acknowledge that. We also know that by being laid over for possible inclusion, there will be a lot of additional time for discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Kent, I notice on page one you say that the position must be a new position and that anyone under contract at the beginning of this school year isn't eligible. Now, South Washington has announced they're making $8.5 million in cuts. Minneapolis just announced cuts in staffing. So why would this grant not be available to retain these positions and these staff members who already have experience in the schools?
Senator Kent.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pratt, first of all, I'll just say that South Washington County is making other arrangements to reduce the amount of cuts that they're going to have to make, but you make a very good point. The point is, the design of this is to make sure we're providing incentives for school districts to add new positions in a sort of a status quo situation. We don't want to be funding positions that already exist, frankly. These are complicated issues, and we can definitely talk about them as we move forward. But the idea is this is a longstanding position over a problem over decades, and we're trying to provide an incentive for school districts to hire new people.
Okay. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But we've already put a number of mandates on schools that have increased the spending out in the tails already. Don't we trust school districts and local boards and administrators to care about kids and try to do their best to balance the needs in the classroom and the needs and support?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Kent.
Senator Pratt, that's why we think this bill is a good, reasonable middle ground. It's totally opt-in. A district does not have to participate if they don't want to, if they feel like they're doing what they need to do to meet their needs. And so they're accountable to their communities. But this, because this is a decades-old challenge and problem, and we have not been able to either mandate our way into the fixes, it has not obviously been handled at the local levels because we are still 48th overall in the counselor ratio. We have I have the notes in front of me, and it's in this report. There are so many districts around this state that do not have, I think 84 districts don't have any counselors. 163 don't have any nurses. These are real problems that have not been changed, have not changed over all these years. And the purpose of this bill is to try to provide a meaningful incentive. We're not using a stick. We're using, I think, a pretty generous carrot. And districts to ultimately have the local control not to participate.
Senator Pratt. Thank you. Just to comment on that, Senator Kent, it seems to me that what we've been doing is putting mandates on schools, telling them how to spend their new money. We haven't put the money on the formula. 1.5% in the last 25 years on average. And so school districts could make these decisions. They could fund these positions had we not encumbered all their new money into new programs. And so to me, I think this is a problem that the legislature has created.
Okay, I think, you know, we'll be debating this when it is, you know, further considered as a potential part of an omnibus bill, but each of you has made your point. Anyone that you would like to just acknowledge their support, and anyone else in the audience very briefly to acknowledge a concern? Senator Kent?
I would just say I am really grateful for the support of a number of organizations, including NAMI. Sue Abderholder is here, in addition to a wide range of other organizations. I won't belabor it. We can send out a list of the supporting organizations. But I've heard no opposition to this bill other than the question about how we spend resources. People like the approach. Organizations like the approach, but obviously it depends on how much funding we're going to have available when you do look at districts around the state, and a real concern to make sure that we do put adequate funding onto the formula. But again, unlike the formula, where we're going to have a tails consideration on that one, there's no tails to this appropriation. This is a one-time, and it fully funds this solution. And it will hopefully put as many as 800 new professionals in these critical positions into our schools and really start making a dent in a very long-standing problem.
Okay. Senate File 1364 is amended to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Next is Senator Claussen, Senate File 557. That'll be followed by Senate File 1501, Senator Torres-Ray. And we invite testifiers for Senator Claussen to please join him and to be mindful of the time constraints. Senate File 557. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Wieger and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to introduce Senate File 557. It's a proposal to appropriate grant funding for school districts to develop science, technology, engineering, and mathematics courses, or STEM courses. Senate File 557 is a request for a $3 million investment to provide grant opportunities through the Minnesota Department of Education to fund STEM-based courses in our schools. The United States has historically been a leader in the STEM fields. However, fewer students have been focusing on these topics in recent years. Currently, 28% of high school ninth graders declare an interest in STEM-related fields, but over half, 57%, lose interest by the time they graduate. The United States is facing a crisis in providing the workforce for STEM industries, which will grow 17% by 2018. And by 2018, the U.S. will have more than a $1.2 unfilled STEM positions in our country. It's imperative we begin to address this workforce need in Minnesota, given the number of STEM-related industries in our state. and Senate File 557 provides the funding to bring STEM-related courses into our schools, motivating student interest and developing the skills for future STEM careers. You might note as well that the Obama administration has identified the STEM field as a critical need. In 2009, he initiated Education to Improve to inspire and motivate students to excel in STEM-related industries. And this week, President Obama announced more than $240 million in pledges for STEM education coming from private industry. We have heard many STEM proposals over the last several weeks here in our committee, one of them being the CTE license issue, which is a requirement for many of the STEM courses in our schools. And just this week, Senate File 1179, Senator Hoffman's Fab Lab was also presented, which is another STEM initiative. Also, we had two task forces recently, the Mental Health Task Force and also the task force to look at health careers in our state that both recommended we need to encourage students to enroll in STEM biomedical courses that will inspire them to continue their education in this field. So, Mr. Chair and Committee, testifying today, we have with us Jim Mecklenburg, Minnesota Project Lead the Way Director, and we also have, seated to my right, the Iron Maidens from the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan Public Schools that will provide testimony.
Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing me to share my perspectives on the proposed legislation. I am Jim Mecklenburg, and I have worked in Minnesota as an educator for the past 39 years. For the past 9 years, I worked out of the Minnesota State College and Universities through the Center of Excellence for Engineering and Manufacturing, sponsored by Minnesota State University Mankato. I am the program director for Minnesota Project Lead the Way, and I help schools implement and sustain a quality Project Lead the Way program. For those of you who are not familiar with Project Lead the Way, I'd like to put on my educator hat. And for those of you that are, I'd like to raise your level of knowledge by one or two levels. I have been involved with Project Lead the Way in Minnesota since it began in 2002 with 6 districts. We are now just under 300 districts. We are also in 6,500-plus schools across the nation. Last year in Minnesota, we had more than 63,000 Project Lead the Way students. To explain the connection between Project Lead the Way and the STEM, I'd like to have a few talking points. And as Senator Claussen said, we know that there's a critical shortage of STEM professionals and that gap is going to continue as us boomers continue on to retirement and that we need increased health care. We also know that women and minorities in the STEM careers are underrepresented. Women make up 48% of our workforce, but hold only 48% of the U.S. jobs in STEM. When we look at the E in STEM, women make up 13% of our engineers, and minorities, just 12%. Project Lead the Way is the largest non-governmental STEM initiative in our state and nation today. Project Lead the Way is a 501(c) nonprofit. And Project Lead the Way provides world-class, real-world, activity-based curriculum that uses problem-solving and teamwork to engage the students from kindergarten to grade 12. Project Lead the Way provides high-quality professional development for educators that is rigorous, giving teachers the necessary pedagogical and content skills necessary to get students engaged in STEM. And I learned long ago in my education career that the most influential way to change education in a positive way is with professional development. I also hear from Project Lead the Way administrators the difference the training makes for the teachers as they come back and initiate the STEM disciplines across. Project Lead the Way courses are aligned to standards, the Minnesota Academic Standards, Common Core Standards, the Next Generation Science Skills Standards, and also Industry Skills. Project Lead the Way is the purest curriculum that we have in our state and nation. And by that, what I mean is that what is being done in Baudette, Minnesota, is the same in Pipestone or Spring Valley or Minneapolis to Los Angeles. The students are getting the same level of instruction. They're on the same curriculum page. Project Lead the Way has assessments to identify and quantify student success. The high school courses have end-of-course assessments that are online. And when a high school student passes a State 9 score, they're able to get university and college credit, university transcripted credit. And they can receive credit in Minnesota from Minnesota State University Mankato, St. Cloud State University, and the University of Minnesota. They can receive 3 undergraduate credits for each high school course, and the fee for the transcripting is $100. We also have a sliding fee for those students on free and reduced lunches. Students also have the option of articulating with our colleges, our community colleges, and technical colleges across Minnesota. There's an extensive network of colleges and universities across the nation. I was recently at Edina High School, and in 2014, Edina had 264 students that qualified for 792 credits. And paying the fee, that's a net savings of $340,969.20, which is a substantial advantage for the students and their families. In Minnesota, we had 1,490 students that received transcripted credit last year. Students understand the rigor that they need to have to be successful in our college and university systems, in our state and our nation. Career exploration for Project the Way students is so important for STEM, so they understand those career pathways available for them. I'm always amazed when I hear the students, and we're going to hear from students in a little while, about their career pathways, their focus. They know what they want to do and how to get there. There's a handout in your packet on the program descriptions, and I'm just going to briefly touch on those descriptions because
Respectfully, it'll have to be very briefly so we can segue to the students.
All right, thank you. You'll see the descriptions. We have a Launch K-12 program. We have Gateway, which is the middle school. We also have high school. In the engineering, we have 9 courses. We've also implemented a Project Lead the Way computer science engineering. So again, our students are coming up with first. I've been privileged to work as a volunteer judge with high tech kids, first technology, and again, that's what we're here for. I am a parent, a grandparent. I believe with my heart and my soul the importance of Project Lead the Way, and with your help, I hope to have that opportunity available for my grandchildren and the students of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. We commend and congratulate you for 4 decades of service. Please, let's hear from the Iron Maidens first Tech yes. Challenge Robotics team.
Yes. We have also Mr. Paul Olson, who is a teacher in Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan Public Schools, and I'll ask Paul to join us, and also a spokesperson that we have, Corey Roberts.
Good. If everybody could please gather around. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Paul Olson, and I'm the secondary math and STEM lead teacher for the Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan School District. I was excited to hear about this bill because allocating grants for districts to provide STEM-based courses is another step, an important step, to help prepare our students for the needs of our future workforce. While districts are increasing the amount of STEM experiences for students, more needs to be done. I'm just going to highlight some of the ways that STEM can be supported with grants. Looking to the future, STEM-related jobs will continue to grow at the same or exceed the pace for non-STEM jobs. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, over the next 5 years alone, science and engineering jobs will grow by about 19%, compared to only about 14% for all occupations. Students need more opportunities for STEM education, especially engineering. To do this, some schools are looking towards innovative solutions like flexible learning spaces that allow teachers to be adjust their learning spaces for whatever needs that they have. Flab labs and maker spaces that give students chances to engage in engineering practices by designing, building, and experimenting. Grants can support courses that give students these hands-on experiences. Computer science is another growth in the STEM field, and that will grow by 19% also over the next decade, outpacing growth for all occupations. Computer programming experiences also need to increase. Many students participate in events like the Hour of Code, where students not only in Minnesota, the United States, but all across the world participated in an event where they did some computer programming. Some students go further by taking computer science courses in high school or participating in after-school clubs. Still, these are only limited opportunities for students to learn computer programming in schools, but STEM grants may create additional opportunities that can reach more students. STEM courses are also opportunities for students to learn, develop, and apply mindsets that are important for success in STEM fields. For instance, students need a growth mindset in order to believe they can develop skills through hard work and dedication. Beyond growth mindset, we need to expand, develop an innovation mindset that promotes effort, initiative, and collaboration. Genius Hour is an example of that that's being incorporated in some classes to give students the opportunity to put those mindsets and habits into practice. Offering more STEM classes gives even more opportunities to foster those mindsets. STEM courses are also provide the opportunity for outreach to populations that are underrepresented in STEM careers, specifically students of color and women. Blacks and Latinos in STEM fields have not kept pace with their population growth. While representing 29% of the working age population, they hold only less than 20% of STEM jobs. Women's STEM jobs are also behind. While representing 48% of the population, as stated earlier, women only hold 28% of jobs in science and engineering. Specifically, when we talk about women, I'd like to point out the Iron Maidens here. They're a talented group of females that have shown continued interest in STEM. These young ladies will grow up to have successful careers, but more STEM courses will increase the likelihood that these girls and others will grow up to have successful STEM careers.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Corey Roberts, and I am a member of the Iron Maidens First Tech Challenge Robotics Team. Three of my fellow teammates are seated behind me, or standing.
Yes, would you like to introduce your teammates?
Here. This is Connie, Atalanta, and Barbara.
Okay, well, we welcome each of you.
We are a group of ninth graders from Apple Valley who put together our all-female robotics team at the beginning of this year. Three of our five team members, one who cannot be here today, had Mr. Olson as our eighth grade mathematics teacher, and I am here to tell you about how STEM classes, and STEM educators have affected me, my team, and more widely all students in application to the proposed bill from Senator Clausen. Personally, Mr. Olson's class has inspired me in several ways. I have always been someone who loves mathematics. My early love for math came from my mother, who was a math teacher herself. However, my love for slightly higher level math has come from my teachers, Mr. Olson in particular. Because of his intermediate algebra class, I was inspired to take geometry last summer. That put me in Algebra 2 this year, and this summer I will be taking pre-calculus, which will put me in Calculus BC next year. That is a college level class that I will be taking as a 10th grader. Mr. Olson's class inspired a chain of events that will get me there, and for that I thank him. Outside of the classroom, Mr. Olson and my 8th grade science teacher inspired me to join our middle school's math team while I was there. When I got to Apple Valley High School this year, I joined the high school's math team. I was placed on the school's varsity math team after a few meets and went to state this year. State on the varsity math team as a 9th grader. Again, because of a chain of events set off by Mr. Olson and other STEM educators that I have had. My story is not unique. STEM educators and the courses that they teach are touching the lives of their students everywhere. STEM is our future. Students who learn STEM will be the future of our society. Over the next few years, our workforce is going to face an even more severe shortage of people with STEM skills than it is currently seeing. While English and history are, of course, important subjects, people with backgrounds in STEM are going to drive our future, keeping us a competitive country. As a robotics team, the Iron Maidens have noticed something a little troubling about levels of interest among students in terms of STEM. We have presented to middle school students about robotics and STEM, and the only true engagement that we saw among those students came from the stereotypes of robotics people, guys who play video games in their basement. However, when we talked to elementary school students, everyone was excited about robotics and STEM. From this, the Iron Maidens have realized that it is imperative to start interest early in STEM. In fact, it has become a focus of our community outreach. By the time that students get to middle school, even, the stereotypes have set in, and it is hard, if not impossible sometimes, to reverse them. Putting more funding into STEM courses, especially at the elementary school level, will help all of our students to stay interested in STEM, and this will keep the driving force for our future going. Thank you.
Thank you. Very impressive. So inspiring. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also, in our audience here, just like to recognize Jordan Strickland. Jordan, would you stand? Jordan is a student at Concordia University, and last year Jordan and I actually began working on a bill for STEM funding, and I just want to recognize her efforts, and she's followed us through for the last 2 years. So appreciate Jordan's participation. Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan. I know Senator Wicklund is very excited about this as an engineer, and you know, to see where women getting involved. And again, the need is there, the opportunity is before you, and we appreciate your very convincing testimony. Senator Claussen, we would be ready for a motion if you have any concluding remarks.
No, Mr. Chair, they've done a much better job than myself, I think. But I would like to move Senate File 557 for consideration in the omnibus bill.
Okay. And Senator Claussen, do they have an excused absence, the students?
They're actually on vacation this week.
Oh. Okay, our day at the Capitol then. So, okay, again, thank you very much. And on Senator Claussen's motion that Senate File 557 be laid over for possible inclusion, all in favor indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. We have next Senate File 1501, Senator Torres Ray. We ask that your testifiers join you at the table now. And we're very mindful of the time limits, and then you'll be followed by Senator Hoffman, Senate File 1528. If there's any other requests I need to be aware of to accommodate out-of-state testifiers, please let me know. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and members, I am very grateful for this opportunity to present Senate File 1501, and I wish more members would be here because I think you are ready for a treat with this presentation. I would like you to know that I met Giovanni Ford 20 years ago. We came together to talk about what do we need to do as people of color to be more engaged in the conversation about early childhood education. And together we built a very large coalition of parents of color to begin to talk about brain development and what we need to do to invest in early childhood education. Interestingly, this coalition has moved forward. And the voices of people of color have become voices that are included on the periphery, but seldomtimes individuals from those communities are invited to testify here. I would like to share with you that in a very recent conversation at the Humphrey Institute, Mr. Giovanni Ford came to talk about his program. And he talked to us, a group of legislators and practitioners, about the fact that we talk about children of color all the time. In particular, we talk about African-American children, and we talk about their deficits, we talk about their behavior, we talk about parents' irresponsibility, we talk about parents' lack of engagement, we talk about achievement gap, we talk about how they don't do well in school. And I was made aware that his program has changed that construct. And that today, African-American parents are coming together to talk about the resiliency of their kids. They're talking about the strength of their kids. they are talking about what they need to do as parents to come together to really talk about African-American children in very different terms. I was quite moved by that testimony, and I made a commitment to Mr. Ford and to the parents that are working with him that I'm going to do everything I can to educate this body and to educate the people who come here to talk about African-American students, African-American families in different terms. And so I invited them to come to bring this proposal to you. And Mr. Ford is going to talk about the incredible achievements that they have accomplished with very little money and extraordinary support from the community. So I am very proud to introduce Giovanni Ford, a good friend and an amazing practitioner, an amazing advocate that has been really doing remarkable work that all of you need to know about.
And Senator Ray, thank you. And Mr. Ford, we look forward to your comments. We can only devote about 7 to 10 minutes on this right now. We recognize the importance. There will be time at a subsequent. We just scheduled this last evening, and we have that amount of time right now. So if we can hit the key points, and then we'll do follow-up.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you so much, and Senator Torres-Wraith, for this opportunity. I do not take it lightly whenever I'm invited to share some of what we are learning as an organization. The name of our organization is We Are the Network for the Development of Children of African Descent. We are a family education center, and our primary focus is literacy development and forming healthy cultural identity in our children and families alike. I want to make two points very briefly. I won't go into detail about our programs because I know that you have a brief in front of you. What I will say about our programs is we have developed, over years, developed intensive after-school reading interventions. It's not homework help. It's an intervention that has been producing 2 to 5 level increase in independent guided reading levels, 100% increase in specific reading skills for the educators in the room. Those are phonemic awareness, phonics and decoding, comprehension, fluency, and vocabulary. But most importantly, in our children and youth, they are building increased self-efficacy, confidence in their intellectual ability. And we're working with the parents to help them understand how literacy development happens, what happens in instruction in school, so that the parents are effectively equipped and prepared to be involved and help the children transfer those new skills back into the classroom setting. We have other youth engagement programs that are targeting middle and high school students that, again, are helping them really begin to see and understand themselves differently, so that they can achieve in school. So that's a real quick synopsis of some of the direct services, but I want to spend most of my remaining minutes talking about why we do what we do and how we do it. As Senator Torres talked about, very often the literature and research really does position African and African American children and parents in a deficit frame. And the result is that our children and our parents receive that and accept that image of themselves. What we have learned over years of turning the dial on the academic proficiency and success of our children is that it's one thing for schools to try and address what's sitting on the surface, low academic achievement, poverty. We talk about those things. But what we have been able to characterize and describe is what we call, we got to get at the root of the issue. If we really want to change the trajectory for our children and our communities, we must acknowledge the disparities sitting on the surface. But if we don't deal with the root issue, we will be here talking about this generation after generation. We have defined 3 core issues that all of our programs get at. Number one is combating self-doubt. So if our children don't believe that they can, they won't. If our parents don't believe that they can be involved and actually change the outcomes of their children, they won't. Second core issue is deconstructing the myths, prevailing myths, about Black folks and the value that they place on education and work. There's a lot of misconceptions that our parents and our children have bought hook, line, and sinker. The truth of the matter is, if we look at the education of African and African-American children in this country over time, Black folks have always been at the forefront of fighting for equitable education for all. But do our children know that truth? Are they surrounded with the books and images that help them understand that truth that precedes them, that we expect them to know about, maintain, and uphold? The third core issue is fighting the paradigm of individualism. So often our children and families who we describe as the most needy are in this silo of isolating behavior. They don't want nobody to know, or it's only me, which then breeds more self-doubt. So through our programs and services, we hold a high value on connecting parents to parents. Everybody has something to teach, and everybody has something to learn. And each and every parent and each and every child is the expert in their life experience. The hardships that you've gone through have made you stronger. But do you see that? Do you understand that? Have you done that self-reflection and inquiry for yourself and your family, but also to share your experience with somebody else? So it's reshaping and reframing how our children and families see and understand themselves. Dr. Asa G. Hilliard, a great scholar, he named three educational imperatives that drive our work. And these are fundamental human questions. He says that we must help our children understand and seek the answer to these three questions. Number one, who am I? How did I get here? And what's my place in the world? Where do I fit? We believe that is the chief aim of education. What happens in school is very important in terms of skill development. But the real education, if our children and families don't know who they are, our focus on literacy. Literacy are the tools that we use to help and equip our children and families to be in that inquiry. Literacy is more than reading and writing. It's reading, writing, speaking, listening, viewing, thinking, and applying. And so we help our families understand and identify their literacy strengths, what they already come with, because then they have the confidence to step out and develop the reading and writing skills that they might be lacking. So again, I thank you for this opportunity to share just a bit of how we approach the work. It is producing higher academic achievement. It is producing increased reading skills and reading levels. Again, our children, 2 to 5 level increase in their independent guided reading levels after a 9-week intervention. And parents are, we're equipping them with what they need to know to help their child transfer those new skills and new confidence back into the school setting so that the children can take fuller advantage of what our schools have to offer. So again, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members and Senator Torres-Ray for this opportunity. And we are very excited about what is possible in terms of our growth. We are a learning organization, and we for years have always taken what we've learned and shared it with other educators and youth service providers across the state of Minnesota through our annual training institute. And we are excited about the potential of what this support and this proposal could do to help us continue to grow and scale the impact of our work.
Thank you, Mr. Ford. And Senator Torres-Ray, we have 2 minutes.
Mr. Chair, I understand the pressure of the calendar. We have several parents who wanted to come and give testimony. I have asked only one to briefly tell you about her experience, but we have many in the audience who wish to have a conversation with you. I hope that we have a future opportunity to bring them back to provide their testimony.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Good morning. I'm Melanie Williams. Well, the program, to me, built me and my son's confidence up to where we want to continue to strive for the best of us. As when my son was in the Sankofa program, his independent guiding reading level went up 5. And as for me, my confidence grew so much that I even enrolled myself back into school so I can maintain and
You're doing very well.
just to show that my confidence is so high that I don't have to give up, that I can still be who I want to be in life. So, yeah, I don't know.
Tell us about your child and who he is.
My child is, his name is Jaheim Massey. He's, when he was in the program, he was in the third grade. Now he's in the fifth grade. He's a, now, at first he never wanted to go to school, and I never wondered why he didn't want to go to school. It's because he didn't have confidence in his reading. So after the program, he was always going to school, excellent in his homework, and now he's a class leader. So with those skills, he strives to be the best. Yes. Thank you.
That's wonderful, and thanks for what you're doing to help.
Yes.
And, you know, in Senator Torres Ray, if the other parents, I know a number of them took off work, and if they'd just like to introduce themselves for the record, and I would commit to, you know, meeting with them and others at a future point. But just for the record, if they'd like to introduce themselves to the committee, and perhaps right by the microphone and state who you are.
Hi, I'm Tamara York Tallman.
And where you're from, too.
I'm from St. Paul, and I'm also a Parent Power graduate.
Okay.
My name is Javonna Harris, and I am also a Parent Power graduate, and I am also from St. Paul.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tamara Burks, and I'm also a graduate. I'm from St. Paul.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, thank you for your support and this opportunity. I'm hoping that Giovanni can really go around the state to talk about the incredible outcomes of the work that they've done. And I very much hope that I am able to get your support to include this in the finance bill. Thank you.
Senate File 1501 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and there'll be an opportunity before the formal discussion of the proposal for the author to work with others regarding the program outcomes, et cetera. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe a point of order. I understand we have a very aggressive agenda, but part of the benefit of the committee is for us to deliberate, and I feel like we're being rushed through. We're not having a chance to interact with the witnesses or the authors, and we've seen this Amen. A couple of times. I would appreciate, you know, that maybe we allow more of that. You know, my question would have been around specifically the appropriation to this particular agency. I mean, we just saw a scandal with CSI in the Minneapolis School District, and I see some reporting and progress reports. But how do we, you know, I guess to Mr. Ford or Senator Torres Ray, how do we know that we're not going to have the same type of I can't think of another word than scandal, but malfeasance, because it seems like you've got a very good program running, some good success already, but to make sure that we are hitting the appropriate targets and meeting the terms of the contract.
Okay.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Torres Ray, and then we're going to proceed.
Thank you. If I may address this, Senator Pratt, I think that is a very important question. You need to know that obviously I get a lot of requests for coming to support programs, and I have said no to all of them, and I have a pretty big pile. I am very open to any suggestions as to how we can incorporate some language of accountability and reporting. So I will welcome your support and that effort. I know that they have built in some very very prescriptive guidelines for reporting back in their programs to their foundations and everything. We can bring that back in here. We can have periodic reviews. But I am absolutely open to that suggestion, and I would like to incorporate that language with your help. I would like to bring that back.
And members, that would be an expectation for any potential recipient, those types of benchmarks and accountability.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you, Senator Torres Ray, and testifiers. We'll go next to Senate File 1528, Senator Hoffman, and we ask that your testifiers join you.
Mr. Chair, Members, thank you for hearing Senate File 1528. This is a proposal to enhance PSEO payments to post-secondary institutions. With me at the table today is Don Lewis, who's the CFO of Anoka-Ramsey Community College, and then Associate Superintendent Jeff McGonigal from Anoka-Hennepin Public Schools. Senate File 1528 proposes to enhance the PSEO payments to post-secondary schools to include equipment and textbooks. Mr. Lewis will go a little deeper in the weeds on the finance side of that. This concurrent funding bill would be more fully fund the actual cost of equipment and textbooks for the Minnesota colleges and universities, thus making more classes and programs available to the PSEO students. It also recognizes that school districts and post-secondary institutions do incur additional costs for students participating in the PSEO, who often have additional significant needs, including the academic support, transcript, social support, high school student and college, and so forth. So, Mr. Chair and members, I know there's a fiscal note being prepared, and it's in the preliminary state waiting for MMB sign-off. But if Mr. Williams wants to walk us through it at the time, he can.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as Mr. Hoffman noted, or Senator Hoffman noted, the fiscal note is currently in the preliminary process, but we have an estimate that the proposal will cost approximately $12.8 million in the first year, fiscal year 16, and then rises by approximately $1 million in the next year, fiscal 17, for $13.8 million, and then in the out years, in the tails, it's approximately $14 million. Section 1 of the bill results in a cost of approximately $4 million annually, and Section 3 of the bill is approximately $9 million.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Williams. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Williams. The passage of this bill, members, will lead to enhanced class offerings for students in a PSEO program. So with that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Mr. Lewis and Mr. McGonigal, and then we'll stand for questions. Mr. Lewis.
Welcome, Mr. Lewis.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Don Lewis. I serve as the Vice President for Administrative Services and Chief Financial Officer at Anoka Technical College and at Anoka-Ramsey Community College. Anoka-Ramsey Community College is very, very proud of its supportive relationship with Minnesota high schools in providing PSEO courses and opportunities. In 2014, our most recently completed fiscal year, Anoka-Ramsey Community College, at its two campuses, one in Coon Rapids and one in Cambridge, Minnesota, served a total of 12,297 students. Of these students, 821 were PSEO students representing 59 different high schools. In addition, we had 136 PSEO students who were homeschooled. This represents about 8% of our student body, much more than a critical mass. These PSEO students enrolled and completed 20,118 college-level credits. We are also very proud to brag with our partners and colleagues at Anoka-Hennepin School District that Anoka-Ramsey Community College saved students over $500,000, or perhaps I should better say, saved the parents of the students over $500,000 in tuition credits just in 2014. Research has also indicated that high school students who complete at least 12 college-level credits, which is typically three or four courses, while they're still in high school, have a much greater chance of not only completing college, but completing college in a timely manner. Student success soars with PSEO involvement. Although the academic model for PSEO provides outstanding benefits, the financial model is somewhat flawed. The revenues the college receives for PSEO credits rarely covers the cost of the tuition, books, and course equipment. At Anoka-Ramsey Community College, the PSEO students may enroll both in online classes and in traditional seated classes. These courses that they took in 2014, of the some 20,000 credits that they took, generated tuition expenses of $3.498 million. Or if we did an average of that, it was $173.73 per credit for the tuition fees. With the 2014 PSEO reimbursement rate at $186.36 per credit, that left only a residual of $12.63 for textbooks and course equipment and fees. On average, PSEO textbook expenses were $36.88 per credit, thus a shortfall of almost $25 per credit. Although this shortfall might not seem significant, you multiply by the number of credits and it does become significant and meaningful to the college. At Anoka Ramsey Community College, this amount was $488,000. This amount was not covered by the PSEO reimbursement formula, and thus the college supplemented this program from its general fund and from other programs it could offer. It basically robbed Peter to pay Paul. Supporting this bill and increasing the amount of revenues available for PSEO textbooks and course equipment and fees will begin to stabilize the financial model. But it will also enhance an already great academic program and open the door to more and more PSEO course offerings, courses that were traditionally not offered because of the high ancillary fees. Courses like anatomy that carries a textbook cost of $245, statistics at $120, Spanish at $154, and a ceramics course that has course equipment at $75. Providing these added resources for textbooks and course equipment will further assist many students in jump-starting his or her college career and readiness, and providing a leg up for so many of our college-bound students. I thank you for your consideration and support this bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff McGonigal. I'm Associate Superintendent for High Schools for Anoka-Hennepin Schools, and I'm here largely supporting this bill on behalf of Anoka-Ramsey and the other post-secondary institutions our students make use of. We recognize that the costs for those institutions are being cross-subsidized by their general funds, and we want our students to have these opportunities. It's a good problem, I guess I'd call it, that we're getting more and more students career and college ready and more students taking advantage of PSEO. We're also proud, and I could speak on this topic at another meeting, of our concurrent options that we're creating with Anoka-Ramsey and Anoka Tech and St. Cloud State and some other institutions. But the costs for supporting the students, going back to the first moving testimony here today about counselors, the fact is these students need significant support, more than the 0.18 fraction that we get for students who are going to college. There's significant support at the college, but there's significant support at our high schools too for career and college readiness, for making sure that these students' credits transfer for high school credit and so on. So this bill would address that concern as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 1528? Senator Bonoff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm Mr. McGonigal, I'm trying to track exactly how it would help the school district. What would you, on a per pupil basis, can you share with us the additional incentive you would have under the conditions of this bill? I get the part about the textbooks for post-secondary. I'm not following yet, though.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I don't have a number. I know that the fraction is changes from 0.18 to 0.35, I believe, in the bill. But it goes back to the first testimony about our counselors. Our counselors are pressed hard to help these students, and it's not a cross-subsidy of money. It's a cross-subsidy of time. The more students we get involved with PSEO, the more their work has to go to those students in supporting them, and the less time we have of them for the other students. With more funding, we would be looking at additional counselor support at our high schools.
Further questions?
Mr. Wilms could yes, just clarify Mr. Wilms. Again.
Chairman Wieger and Senator Bonoff, one thing I should have made clear earlier was Section 1 of the bill pertains to payments to post-secondary institutions, but Section 3 of the bill actually would increase aid entitlements to school districts. So in that case, Section 3 of the bill would provide an incremental secondary adjusted daily membership of approximately $1,200 per student based on the estimated students. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Arneson if he has anything he'd like to add.
Mr. Arneson?
Mr. Chair, members, just to enhance what Mr. Wilms said, the extra $1,000 per student that would be retained by the residents or the serving school district sort of assumes that the student is more or less a full-time PSEO student. So in the case of a student sort of maxing out their PSEO availability, that $1,000 approximately would be the increment newly available and staying at the school district.
Thank you.
Sarah Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to follow up on that, so is that $1,000 something that is above their per pupil allocated for that district?
Mr. Chair and Sarah Kiffmeyer, so the PSEO statutes currently indicate that the minimum ADM for a student enrolled in a PSEO program is 0.12. So that 0.12 ADM in any case would be the minimum retained by the school district. The bill language would increase that minimum ADM to 0.35, and the sort of difference between one-eighth ADM and one-third ADM is approximately that $1,000. So that ADM count would be then kind of summed up together with all the other ADM at the school district and run through the gen ed model and any other school finance formula that depends on ADMs, and then those would be the revenues accruing to the school district.
Sarah Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my more straightforward question was, does this increase to the school district what they were getting before? Or is this just a redistribution of the current allocation?
Senator Wiegert and Senator Kiffmeyer, the short answer is yes, it would increase the revenues to the school district.
Further questions, comments? Thank you, Senator Hoffman. A testifier is sent file 1528. It will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And next is Senate File 1206, Senator Johnson, and we ask that your testifiers join you at the table. We do have a number of handouts regarding the full-service community school establishment proposal.
Mr. Chair and members, I appreciate the limitation on time. I've been asking my testifiers to really select what is very important for them to tell us from their viewpoint.
Okay, and Senator Johnson, I believe there's an author's amendment that's being distributed. And have you seen it?
Yes, I have, and I'm very supportive of it.
Okay, I'm going to take a look. Well,
it wasn't just the A1 amendment.
Senator Johnson moves the author's amendment, the A1. All in favor, indicate aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Adopted. Senate File 1206 as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, this provision came to me from communities that have community schools and also from teachers. And I'd like to start out by letting you know what is a community school. Coalition for Community Schools is an alliance of national, state, and local organizations in education. Their mission is to advance opportunities for the success of children, families, and communities. The Coalition for Community Schools believes that strong communities require strong schools, and strong schools require strong communities. We envision a future in which schools are centers of thriving communities where everyone belongs, works together, and succeeds. Members, I think this fits in with what I see as our goals for this year is our future workforce, meeting the needs of children to keep them in school and keep them to grade level so that they're not falling back. Just yesterday, I had a discussion with a constituent who came into my office who was working in the corrections area. He told me, as I was talking about my initiatives in education, that his finding is that if children can read at grade level by third grade, they will not be in the correction system. That's what he said. He didn't provide me any information, but I do believe there's a lot of truth to that. So members, with that, I will turn this over to our testifiers. We have two school districts who have community schools, the Duluth and Brooklyn Center. So I have the people with me.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Welcome to the testifiers.
Hello, thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Patrice Howard. I represent Brooklyn Center Community Schools as the Director of Community Schools and Partnerships. Brooklyn Center Community Schools is the first full-service community school district in the state of Minnesota and still is the only full-service, thank you, community school district in the state with over 100 partnerships, many of which are co-located services. We began this work many years ago, but began the implementation of the national model in 2009, quickly gaining results by 2010, and hiring a full-time district administrator, which would be me. At Brooklyn Center Community Schools, we work relentlessly to provide integrated services that complements the 8 components addressed by the Coalition of Community Schools that supports the whole child, and that's in that colorful document there. You can learn about the 8 components. My work includes the coordination of partnerships, facilitation of action planning teams, grant writing, evaluation and reports, identifying needs through asset mapping and needs-based assessments, and negotiating services and agreements in addition to MOUs. I also oversee 3 departments, family engagement and community engagement, out-of-school time programming and health and wellness. I believe in this model. I've seen its fruit from around the country, several national models, as well as firsthand in Brooklyn Center, whether that's through the 3,000-plus individuals accessing our free on-site medical services, 200 of which are mental health services, 200 of which have received mental health services, or 700-plus youth accessing our 21st-century programs at the middle and high school, with another 400 or so accessing similar opportunities at our elementary school, delivered through our partners at no cost to our district or our families. Or that's through our families becoming successful through self-sufficiency, whether that's graduating from one of our parent education programs or by accessing and utilizing services in addition to our family nights, or increased student attendance and graduation rates. As a full-service community school district, we believe in eliminating and reducing barriers through uniting communities and staying true to the notion that school is the hub of the community. We also believe in the work of the national founder Joy Dry Foods that the community school model provides services all day and every day. This has been taxing work, but it's very much needed. Just Monday, I made a daily round to one of our family resource rooms where I encountered a young man, a middle schooler. So our family resource rooms are housed with both the coordinator and a cultural liaison. I came into this room, I saw this young man. It was during one of our class periods, and I asked what was he doing there, and he said he was referred down by his teacher to see Ms. Starr, who's the coordinator. Well, Ms. Starr wasn't in the room, so I asked, could I help him? And he said, well, she should be back. Within a minute, Ms. Starr came back. She had a tape measure in her hand. I couldn't figure out what was going on. Quickly, she asked the young man to remove his shoe. There, she measured the size of the young man's foot. She said, yes, sweetie, you actually wear a 10. Your shoes are a size 12. I quickly looked down and noticed that the young man had on a shoe that's two sizes too big. From there, she told the young man to go back to class and that she would reach out to partners, and by the end of the day, she would have that young man a pair of shoes. Later on in the day, we investigated a little bit more and found out that the little man was a part of a family that was recently displaced. So not only was he wearing a shoe that was too big, but also he was his family was homeless now and needed additional resources, including your basic needs. With having on-site family resource rooms that complements the community school models, we were able to meet that need head on. That student doesn't have to worry about his self-esteem while wearing a shoe size too big, and that there will be no barrier posed for learning because we have addressed that need head on. So I want to thank Senator Johnson for bringing this bill forward and thank Senator Wieger for co-authoring this. This bill is my work. It's what I do every day, and so soon you'll hear testimonies from a couple of my other colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Stephanie Heilig, and I have the extreme pleasure of being the principal at Myers-Wilkins Community Schools up north in Duluth. Every day I remind my beautiful children, and in case you didn't get the memo, I probably do have the most beautiful, wonderful children on earth at my school. Yes. I remind my children every single day that I only have 2 jobs. That is to ensure that they are learning and to keep them safe. And I take that job extremely serious. Myers-Wilkins is a school that's made up of 83% of our students on free and reduced lunch. 53% of them are students of color. This year, we have had a turnover rate of over 20% of our kids, with kids moving out and coming in, a very transient population. Anywhere between 10 and 15% of our children at any one time are homeless. 19% of our children receive special ed, and we have been classified as a racially isolated school by the Minnesota Department of Education. But those statistics do not really tell what Myers-Wilkins is about. At Myers-Wilkins, we have a philosophy that every single child that walks through that school door belongs to all of us, and we have the collective responsibility to ensure we give them the best education possible. Through the years of hard work, planning, joint teacher and community school development, parent advice — we take a lot of parent advice — the Myers-Wilkins Community School Collaborative has helped our school to become a model for enhancing social-emotional learning and decreasing the achievement gap. According to our MCA test from last year, the achievement gap reduction domain measures the ability of schools to get higher levels of growth from lower performing student groups than the statewide average for high performing groups. In math, the following groups for Myers-Wilkins were making more growth than white students statewide in closing the achievement gaps. And those groups of children are Asian, our special education, Hispanic, and American Indian. The proficiency index rate of each group is compared to a target that the Minnesota Department of Ed sets for us. The groups for Myers-Wilkins that met and greatly exceeded the state target in math and reading last year were our American Indian students, black students, special ed, and free and reduced lunch. This continued reduction of the achievement gap can be attributed to the best practices happening in our classroom and the partnership between our classroom teachers and the after-school collaborative through a seamless process. We meet together in professional learning communities. We communicate with each other every single day. Individual learning plans are developed together. And we respect the work that each other does. There is always so much to do to ensure that our children learn and are safe. Community schools at Myers-Wilkins, as good as it is, cannot do it alone. Our wonderful, active, supportive parents that I just adore can't do it alone. Our dedicated teachers, they certainly cannot do it alone. And I, although I wish I could, I cannot do it alone. But when we pool all of our resources, the love of the children, our collective wisdom, and limitless energy — oh, it's not always limited, but usually it's limited, limitless — we are a force to be reckoned with, and we do make a difference in the lives of our children. I want to thank Senator Johnson very much for bringing this bill forward, and for Chair Wieger for co-authoring the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would like to ask Ms. Howard to make one more statement that was very meaningful to me, so if she would — she knows what I'm asking about.
So I briefly mentioned that we provide services for over 3,000 annually through our on-site medical clinic. What that is a community clinic sponsored by both Park Nicollet Foundation, Park Nicollet Clinics, and United Way. We provide free medical services twice a week without access and medical insurance. We also provide free mental health services, as well as mental health services that do charge those who have insurance. But access for our individuals trying to access those services. We also have dental on site and free vision. So all through our partnerships, we've been able to provide these services for our youth and the community.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Mr. Chair and committee members.
Any testifiers, we encourage everybody to join.
All right. My name is Bernie Burnham, and I am the president of the Duluth Federation of Teachers. Our DFT believes that the Duluth schools can close the gaps between students of color and white students, and that expanding the full-service community school model is one of the best ways we'll be able to accomplish that. We believe that the best solutions for improving our schools and communities come from educators, parents, youth workers, and students. That's why we're here today advocating for full-service community schools. As a media specialist at Laura MacArthur, I can say that the educators and our staff there are proud to have achieved celebration status last year and now reward school status this year. We are working hard to keep improving. However, short-term turnaround funding like the school improvement grant that Laura MacArthur received is limited in its ability to sustain long-term partnerships like those that have been successful at Myers-Wilkins. That is why the Duluth Federation of Teachers is calling on the legislature and the governor to pass the full-service community schools legislation, and I would like to thank you for this opportunity to speak.
Thank you. Welcome.
Welcome. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jen Eddy, and I'm the executive director of the Myers-Wilkins Community School Collaborative. We know that poverty's impact on children often leads to academic underperformance and limited access to education and social cultural opportunities. One of my main roles as a community school coordinator is building intentional partnerships in order to support that academic success and the well-being of the whole child. At Myers-Wilkins, one of our greatest strengths is all our partners that we bring into the school, and we have over 25 well-established partnerships with different community organizations, businesses, and colleges. In the last year, we were able to serve over 400 children in our after-school programs because of all those different partners that would come into our school and help us. Based on the research and promising practices of the Coalition of Community Schools, we are able to offer an extensive array of after-school and summer enrichment activities, academic interventions, family and cultural learning events. We had over 28 different family events in the last year. Also dental care and different mental health services. Although Myers-Wilkins is the highest poverty and most racially diverse school in Duluth, it has never been cited by the state of Minnesota for low achievement or failure to meet the achievement gap reduction goals. Additionally, with our summer program, we do not see students experiencing the summer slide, which is a three-month or more regression of learning over those summer months. With us today, we also have Lucretia Grant, and she participated in our summer Hillside Theater program in elementary and in middle school, and she just wants to share what that experience has meant for her.
Thank you, and welcome, Lucretia.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm so thrilled to be before you today to speak and sort of testify. I did have the opportunity, along with my older brother and my younger sister, to participate in the Summer Hillside Theater program put on by the community, and it was such a great experience for us. My brother was a facilitator. He was in high school at the time, so he sort of helped with the younger children, and my sister and I worked in the costume shop and helped to design sets, and it was just a really wonderful experience for us to be able to go there together every single day during the summer. And I can really just testify that it has really made an impact on our lives. My mother is a single mother and didn't have a college education at the time when she got us into these programs. But since my brother has studied musical theater at Boston Conservatory, he has his master's in musical theater, and he's now in the Broadway tour of the Jersey Boys, and it'll be here in May for anybody who's interested. And so he just, you know, constantly says that theater changed his life, because before theater was introduced to him at such a young age, he was maybe on a different track, right? So that is just, it makes me feel really good. And also my sister, she's ending her first year of graduate school at Howard University. She's getting a master's in English. I graduated from Augsburg College in 2011, and I've been working ever since in the community. I'm also an educator at a clinic. And my mother, just to share this little piece, feeling so inspired that her three children, got four-year degrees. She is ending her first year getting her AA degree at Lake Superior College in Duluth. So we're just so thankful for these programs and know that they really have changed our lives and help us to get to a really wonderful place. So I just wanted to share that story, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for the inspiring message. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Good day, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Will Finley. I'm the 21st Century District Program Coordinator for Brooklyn Center Community Schools, and I want to talk to you a little bit about our students in our secondary building, 6th through 12th grade, regularly participating in after-school programs that received a C or lower in reading in the first quarter in the 2013-14 school year. Of those students, 43% improved their grade from the first quarter to the fourth quarter. In addition to students' progress in reading, we also examined students' progress in math. 6th through 12th graders, regularly participating students who are struggling in math, receiving a C or lower in the first quarter, 45% improved their grades from the first quarter to the fourth quarter in math. Brooklyn Center secondary students come from diverse backgrounds representing many cultures and languages. Most students are from low-income families. More than 40% of low-income students who struggled in reading and math in their grades from the first quarter to the fourth quarter, 45% and 42% respectively. More than half of the English language learners made improvements in math, 55%, and 67% improved their grades from a C in the first quarter to the fourth quarter. Programs are student-driven at Brooklyn Center, from homework labs to technology that includes robotics, drones, game designs, and even entrepreneurial programs where students can learn to earn their keep. With the leadership of the site coordinator, these academic achievements, programs, growth, and development are possible for future U.S. leaders. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for this opportunity.
Thank you.
Let me say, Mr. Chair, if I might, Superintendent Keith Lester from Brooklyn Center would have liked to have been here, not able to, but he said he's willing to contact each member of this committee to talk to them about how important he thinks this whole initiative is. So I wanted to add
Thank
that.
You. Okay.
Good morning, Welcome. Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you. My name is Michelle Ald. I am a parent of a student at Brooklyn Center Secondary. My children have participated in and benefited from the many, many programs and partnerships at BCS through the full-service community schools model, the on-site health resource center. Beyond the convenience to our family, it has played an important role in the health and safety of my children. When concerned about a possible concussion, the coach was able to send my daughter directly to the health resource center to be immediately screened. The out-of-school time programming, the after-school homework lab has helped to support academic support for my daughter. They have scattered practice times in the winter, and often they don't get to practice until 5 or 6. But with Homework Lab, she's been able to get her homework completed with any questions or confusions addressed with the on-site teacher, and it's all done before practices, keeping her grades high and truly becoming a student athlete. College and career support. My oldest daughter is currently a student at the University of Minnesota. She had the opportunity through Brooklyn Center Community Schools and out-of-school time programming to develop a student-intern partnership last summer, which led directly into her senior research project for this year. Full-service community schools connects the dots for student success all the way through college and to career readiness. The collaboration of services and the seamless integration of all the programs and partnerships through the community school site coordinator has made the full-service community model, schools model work for my family and many, many others, ensuring academic and personal success. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thanks. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for this opportunity to speak with you about the community schools model. I'm Kathy Bogan, a founding member of the Myers-Wilkins Community School Collaborative in Duluth, Minnesota. With encouragement from the Department of Children, Families, and Learning, our community members came together over 16 years ago to develop and implement the community school strategies so that all of our young people would have the experiences and support needed to succeed in school, community, and life. Academic achievement does not take place in a vacuum. It's the result of multiple factors in a young person's life. Among these are their educational experiences, their physical and mental health, safety and stability of their home and community environment, participation in enrichment activities, and relationships with caring adults. The community school model addresses both the academic rigor and the multifarious factors that influence young people's learning by locating needed services and supports at the school site. In the interest of closing achievement gaps in academic achievement and graduation rates, we would like to see the community school model implemented at other schools in our city and across the state. Across our nation, schools implementing the community school model are showing measurable results in closing the achievement gap and increasing high school graduation rates. For this reason, a bipartisan bill to expand community schools has been introduced in the United States House of Representatives. Several states have passed legislation approving funding to support community schools. We are really hopeful that Minnesota will also become a leader in this movement by passing legislation during the 2015 session. Our young people and communities look to you to provide leadership that will effectively close the achievement and opportunity gap that exists in Minnesota. Supporting a bill that will provide funding for community school coordinators in our most high-needs schools is a cost-effective strategy that will empower communities to do this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That concludes our testimony, Mr. Chair. I'd like to point out one letter to you that I believe you all have a copy from Andrea Baker, a food service employee from Minneapolis Public Schools. The reason I want to call it to your attention is because she talks about her son who found out that he needed eyeglasses early on, and I didn't solicit it. So thank you. If are there any questions, we'll be happy to have them if there's time. If not, I would.
Questions from the committee, and then we'll open it up for anyone in the audience that would like to weigh in as well. Anyone like to testify on Senate file 1206 as amended? And Senator Johnson, I assume you'll be working with various stakeholders that may have an interest with the Department of Education and others that would have a direct role
in
this.
Yes, we have been in contact with the Department of Education and will continue to be.
And counties would obviously have a great deal of interest in that partnership as well.
I think everyone should be interested in this.
Okay. Additional comments? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Johnson, I'm just looking at the bill, and I have to admit, I still don't know what a community school is. Because what we talk about is, on line 1.14, community school programming means services, activities, and opportunities described in Subdivision 2, Paragraph G. When I go to Subdivision 2, Paragraph G, what I see are a bunch of tasks that they do, but I don't see any description of the services that they're intended to provide. And so, right, I see they have to have establish a consistent operation of school leadership. They have to maintain attendance records. They have to have measurable data showing annual participation, documentation of meeting and sustained collaboration between schools and community stakeholders. It doesn't tell me what we're trying to accomplish.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
First of all, just my note on it before I ask Ms. Burr to comment. Each of these schools will be different because it reflects what your community needs. It isn't a one standard fits all, and that's why it's somewhat difficult to be absolutely direct. But again, Ms. Burr could comment.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senator Pratt, thank you. Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. Thank you for the question, Senator Pratt. Senator Johnson actually did answer the question correctly. The bill is designed intentionally to not be prescriptive. as to exactly what the services would have to include. I think you heard from the array of testifiers that spoke so eloquently before I came up here about the various types of services that they either offer in Myers-Wilkins or Brooklyn Center and or the students who have gone through them. So there is an array. The tasks that you see are also intentional because we want what's considered the needs assessment that needs to be conducted by the site coordinator with the partners, with the schools, with the parents, with the students, is meant to be very detailed and get to the heart of what the local needs are for those students, those parents, those communities. And so the services, Senator Pratt, we expect should be very different from school site to school site.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's all well and good. As you know, Ms. Boer, I'm a big fan of local control and having local districts determine their needs, but I'm still struggling to see, other than a mandate of you know, at least two types of programmings, any real goals, definitions of what it means to be a community school, because a lot of these are already being done through local ECFEs, and they have their own separate levies. School districts, you know, Senator Hoffman and I talk all the time about the partnerships that our former districts have developed. I'm still struggling to see what's new here.
Did you wish to have an answer? Was there a question? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure out what a full service community school is. It's not defined in the statute.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'm going to turn it back over to Patrice Howard. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Howard, on the definition.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and committee member, Senator Pratt. Although it may not be listed definitely here, but community schools is a set of partnerships based on a set of needs which Ms. Burr just announced to you all. So in my position, in order for us to meet the needs of our community, we had to conduct a very comprehensive need-based assessment. So it wasn't us just going out and saying, this is what our community school is. It was all based on the needs that were collected throughout that needs-based assessment. And that's also indicated in our document, in the materials that you all have there. But within our school district, the priority being that medical needs were, in fact, the priority. So that involved a series of reporting. No one else was responsible for reporting and analyzing that data. We took indicators from the full service model laid out by the Coalition of Community Schools. The Coalition of Community Schools already has a number of indicators set out for districts who do, in fact, plan to take on this model. So all of that is available to us if districts are interested in being a full-service community school model. So there's no need to recreate what's already there, so to speak.
Senator Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you have an idea of how many districts would or schools would be eligible for or would qualify under this? I see some limitations. It has to have an integration plan, but
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, committee members, again for the record, Jody Boer with Education Minnesota. Senator Stump, the answer to that is we hope as many as possible, and part of that depends on the total amount of the appropriation. So within the bill, you will see that there are two asks for funding. One is specifically for the site coordinator. The other is one-time funding for programmatic expenses. And so if you do quick math, that's about $120,000, depending on how much the total appropriation is. I'll throw out a number, $5 million. It would be approximately 40 schools that could participate. And if the appropriation is lower, obviously it would be less.
Just to
Sarah Stump.
Mr. Chairman, in Brooklyn Center, you know, over the years, that's been a very unique school district, and it was almost impossible for them to pass a referendum. And so they, and plus there's been a tremendous demographic kind of a change in that community. So Linda Scheid over the years worked very, very hard, and I kind of came up with that concept that in order to really make improvements in that district, you know, if they had the services that you've talked about, they could do it, and they did it. And they did a lot of it in the beginning without any public help, basically, or at least state help. So I think the concept is tremendous. I'm not sure if it's very clearly defined as to how many districts actually would need that that intensive help from the state. And I realize that it's, each district isn't getting a lot of money through this particular program. But there's a lot of preparatory work to make this happen, because you have to get all these different service providers together, and that's a challenge in itself. But the concept is terrific, and I think the outcome is good too.
Senator Johnson, you have a lot of guidance. And
I would like to first state Senator Wieger that we would be happy. I really appreciate all of the interest. I think it's great, and I think there are many things that we could tell you about this project that would probably help you to understand better how it can become part of many, many schools, and what you need to do. So, therefore, if you're interested, we can set up a time where you're able to come in, and I would ask Jody and maybe some other people who have good information to come and talk with us about it some more. And with that, then I would ask that you lay this over and include Senate File 1206 in the
yes. With that commitment from the author and the invitation for others with interest, Senate File 1206 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much to the testifiers. We have three bills remaining. We'll allot 10 minutes for each. We're going to go first to Senator Saxhog's proposal 1323, followed by Senator Wicklund 1437, and Senator Torres Ray 1188. Senator Saxhog, and you have your testifiers. Welcome, and thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Northern Minnesota has three major education funding challenges. While not unique, more pressing than some other parts of the state for these particular three. One's transportation sparsity, for obvious reasons, the size of the Northern Minnesota districts, the underfunding of Native American students in our schools, and third, this bill, Senate File 1323, which deals with seasonal recreational property taxation. In 23 school districts, the referendum market value equalization tiers are not having their intended impacts. The bill boosts the local optional revenue equalizing factor for school districts where more than 30% of the district's market value is in non-commercial seasonal recreational properties, cabins, summer homes. That would be another explanation. So with me today are Kathy Patino, Superintendent Pine River Bacchus, Jolene Bankston, Business Manager, Pine River Bacchus, and Deb Wanick, Superintendent of Pelican Rapids. They're going to give some brief presentations and answer any questions.
Thank you. Thank you. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you. Chairman Wigger, committee members, my name is Kathy Patino, and I've been the Superintendent of Schools at Pine River Bacchus for the past 12 years.
My name is Jolene Bankston. I'm a Pine River Bacchus graduate and the Business Manager there for the last 5 years.
Okay. We want to thank Senator Saxhog for authoring this legislation, and we are appreciative of the recently legislated local levy authority that enables us to maintain our educational programming at Pine River Bacchus Schools. Though the levy authority gives access to vital revenue, the exclusion of seasonal rec property places a large burden on local residential property owners.
That burden becomes compounded when you consider local indicators. While Pine River Bacchus is located in Lake Country and appears property wealthy, the reality is that our district has a 62% free and reduced lunch count. Our median household income is $42,000. MREA put together the spreadsheet that's in your handouts today. Color-coded maps are on one side showing where all these high property wealthy districts are located in the state. On the back.
Excuse me, members, I don't believe we have the color-coded version, but
okay, the black and white. Got the black and white version. Okay. Apologies.
Others do. Okay.
The 22 districts are listed on the back on the spreadsheet. And if you notice, at the bottom are state averages and then the district averages for these 22 districts. The state averages a seasonal rec percentage of 5.6%. Our districts are at 42.9%. Median household income as a state average is $54,000, and our district's average $45,000. Free and reduced lunch count statewide is 39%, and our districts are hovering around 50%. What this bill would do is give these districts with high seasonal rec values and high poverty areas an option to lower their levy, their LOR levy, by enhancing the equalization. That last column shows the change in local levies for the LOR portion. For a state price tag at the bottom of $597,000 for the first year.
Okay.
If there's one thing that we can tell you about Pine River Bacchus, it's that we have an amazing community. From students and parents to staff to volunteers and local businesses, the support is there. We're not a wealthy community, but we're very hardworking, and we are willing to pay our fair share. The inequity between high-valued tax bases and high-poverty populations puts a greater burden on our residents and must be addressed. The enhanced equalization proposed in Senate File 1323 will make a tremendous difference in our district and will allow our people the pride of knowing they contribute to our schools without sacrificing their families' needs.
With another round of budgeting in the works for next year, there's already discussion at the local level of how to reduce our district's LOR levy and its impact on local property taxes. The enhanced equalization in 1323 would allow us to reduce that local levy burden, but keep the same amount of revenue needed to give the same level of excellence to our students. Thank you for letting us present to you today.
Thank you. Very well choreographed. Superintendent.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Deb Wanick, and I'm the superintendent of Pelican Rapids. And I just want to thank you for the complexities I know that you deal with every day. I really want to reiterate, I really appreciate that LOR was a tremendous impact for us. And after today, I even have a greater appreciation for the endurance you have of listening to people asking for money all day long. I'd like to share a story, and I don't want this to look at a joke. We have some students. We're in northern Minnesota, but we still have 40% of our population is minorities, and we have ESL students, some new to country. And many of you know the difficulties in learning our language. And so I don't want you to look at this as a joke, but more of a poignant story of an earnest young girl trying to learn our language. And in third grade, was writing a story, and the story in it had that the fireman went into a fire and came out pregnant. And so you ask the young girl what this means, and in all earnestness, she said, well, with child. Pregnant means with child. So the fireman went in and came out with child. So you think of how difficult it is to learn our language, and then you look at our MCA requirements and how deep you need to understand. And so I'm just thrilled that we had such great increases in our test scores this year. It was really exciting to see. And I share that with you because even though we're talking about money, I cannot tell you the emotional impact it is on our district to run a levy. It took us four times to pass a levy. And each time, our teachers had to get more involved because it's for them. The community wanted to see them out there. So when you spend your time and energy running a campaign, and you know it's hard for the district office, it's terrible for teachers because teachers have a full-time job the way it is. So when we're asking for this particular bill, you can see Pelican Rapids, our stats, that we certainly have a high level of seasonal rec, and we have a high level of free and reduced. We have our minorities group, and we work really hard. So this would be a tremendous impact that when we do go to the voters, because our voters, because of our high seasonal rec, are very aware of our homestead people know that our seasonal rec. We have beautiful lakes, and we live close enough to the Fargo area that we have a lot of North Dakota residents that come and have their cabins there, which it's wonderful, but they're on the northern side of the district. They don't often even come into our town, much less by our school, because we're far enough, or close enough to Fargo that they can just buzz back and forth for all their needs. So to have this would really help our district in a great way so we can continue working on student achievement.
Thank you very much, Superintendent. Is there anyone in the audience that'd like to address Senate File 1323? Questions from the members? Senator Claussen, and then we'll entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question on that first column after the district name is the percent of the total market value. But when you look at dividing up the revenue that you get from the non-homestead, non-residents, and your residents, what does that come out to as far as what percent of your total revenue stream, you know, comes from the non-residents versus your residents? Because those people are paying, you know, a higher tax rate on their homes because they're non-residents.
I don't have that, Dad. I'm sorry.
I understand the question.
Sure. I'll try again. You've got two types of residents in your area, the non-residents who own lakeshore property or recreational property, and then you've got the people that are year-round residents. And if you look at the total revenue from each of those two groups, what percentage makes up the non-resident of your total school revenue that comes in?
Of our total?
No, how many people that are that high population, high income are paying your taxes? How many people in the lakes?
Because I would say on average they're paying more in taxes than the people, depending upon, you know, the home that they have or the property they have.
I would agree. I don't have that information, although I do know that we have a community in town that has a very poor group. So I know that the seasonal or the residential people on the lake do pay more. They have a higher income and a higher home, but it is very difficult for our community people within the town to pay their share too. You know, I've been fighting seasonal rec for a long time. So if you can, if you look at our particular district, we don't have a very high levy. If we were to take seasonal rec off of the state tax and they paid, our seasonal rec paid our levy, their taxes would drop to a third because it's not very much. But when it's taken off, then all of our residents pay a tremendous amount more. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't cure that issue that I'm fighting, but it does give us some relief.
That
was, thank you, Superintendent.
That was kind of the point I was trying to get at, so thank you.
Okay. Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 1323 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. In favor, indicate aye.
Aye. Aye.
Adopted. Thank you to
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair
Saxog and your testifiers. Next, Senator Wicklund, Senate File 1437. We invite your testifiers. And we thank the testifiers for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm here to present Senate File 1437. It's a bill that has to do with wilderness inquiry research and teacher professional development appropriation. This bill is a request for an appropriation to be made to the Department of Education to fund a grant to wilderness inquiry for two purposes. One is for research to implement a project that focuses on the socio-emotional impact of place-based education. And the second is for teacher professional development to provide resources, training, and support for teachers to participate in place-based education professional development opportunities on a statewide basis. Wilderness Inquiry has already been doing research on whether place-based education boosts academic achievement, and I will let my testifier discuss the positive results they've seen. This grant would allow them to research student and classroom benefits of teacher-led place-based activities, benefits such as stress reduction and increased attention spans, which we know will also lead to academic gains for students. In the area of teacher professional development, Wilderness Inquiry has already been successfully conducting teacher development programs, and their curricula is ready to be deployed to train and support teachers throughout the state. Here to talk more about the programs and the proposal are Greg Lace, Executive Director, and Chad Dayton, Director of Programs and Partnerships.
Thank you, Senator, and welcome to the Test Bars. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Greg Lace. And in 1978, we founded Wilderness Inquiry to bring the outdoors to Minnesotans from all walks of life. Since then, we've served almost 500,000 people from every corner of the state. In 2008, in collaboration with the National Park Service, the Minnesota DNR, and many others, including the Legislative and Citizens Committee on Minnesota Resources, Senator Hoffman, we started the Urban Wilderness Canoe Adventures Program, serving disadvantaged students through what we call place-based education, which is a form of experiential learning that is particularly effective in engaging students in a multitude of subjects. Essentially, we're turning the outdoors into a classroom and prepping teachers on how to use it. Since 2008, we've reached 75,000-plus students, and we're here to ask for support from this committee for Senate File 1437. My colleague, Chad Dayton, will explain some of the details. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Chad Dayton, and I am the Director of Programs and Partnerships for Wilderness Inquiry. Over the years, and with the support of many, we've evolved a way of connecting public schools to public lands that works and that is cost-effective. Our approach is to treat local public lands as an extension of the teacher's classroom, to get the kids there, and to help teachers teach their regular curricula in a new and more engaging context, the real world. Our Urban Wilderness Canoe Adventures program currently engages 26 of Minnesota's 300-plus school districts and serves 15,000 Minnesota youth annually. We are in the process of continued expansion in both numbers served and school districts engaged. From the outset of the Urban Wilderness Canoe Adventures program, we have worked with the University of Minnesota's Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement to evaluate the impact of these place-based experiential opportunities. This nearly decade-long longitudinal programmatic evaluation clearly identifies numerous positive outcomes, including improved behavior, improved attendance, increased engagement, improved teacher-student relationships, improved sense of self, increased curiosity about the natural world, and increased community connection. Now it is essential to quantify a different type of data, a research project focused on the direct connection between place-based education and socio-emotional indicators. Assessing the effects of place-based education on stress, attention span, and disruptive behavior will clearly link the positive impact of place-based education and the socio-emotional framework for required for successful learning. This research project will complete the case for place-based education as an integral component for successful learning and increased academic success. Additionally, interested teachers are too often required to pay out of pocket for access to high-quality professional development opportunities. Our request for teacher professional development funding will allow us to continue to engage teachers throughout the state and facilitate their participation in place-based educational professional development opportunities and support their implementation of these curricular enhancements. These professional development opportunities allow teachers to explore ways to connect their existing curricula to the outdoors, not reinvent what's already working. We firmly believe that place-based experiential opportunities, especially as an integrated component of the school day, positively impact both the academic achievement and opportunity gaps. This research project will allow us to concretely identify physiological indicators proving socio-emotional impacts leading directly to increased academic success. Teacher professional development funding will facilitate the engagement of up to 100 additional teachers statewide in explorations of ways to use the outdoors, primarily public lands, as a viable, meaningful, and impactful extension of the classroom. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you again. Greg and I are happy to entertain any questions at this time.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Senator Wicklund, for bringing this bill forward. I was blown away many times going out to the Wilderness Inquiry, and I showed up wearing a three-piece suit and realized that I was going to be digging around finding certain pests and insects and entomology that was there. And so I think it's well worth our investment. And not only that, we had Senator Johnson, we had students from Blaine and Coon Rapids that came down there to participate that wouldn't have otherwise had that opportunity. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify? If not,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say I really think that this is a good investment for the state. The program is established and has the tools necessary to not only implement the research project, but also to go further with professional development, which would benefit a lot of teachers in Minnesota. So I would like to move that Senate File 1437 be recommended as
for possible
inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
On that motion, further discussion? Not all in favor indicate aye.
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 Adopted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
And finally, we have Senate File 1188, and we ask Sue Eberholden and any other potential testifier to join Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to present Senate File 1188. Members, we've talked about this concept before, and I have an expert with me who's worked on this issue for a very long time. This bill is intended to provide some resources to the schools to actually conduct some training and provide technical assistance to reduce the use of seclusion and restraint. And so with me, I have Ms. Sue Eberholden, who's been working on this issue, have a little bit of history about the report that was given to the legislature and has been working with professionals and schools around the state of Minnesota to really document the need for these particular funding, because the schools really want to do the right thing, but they need to be providing, they need to have the resources and the training that builds that capacity within each school district. So, Ms. Eberholden.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Eberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. And in 60 seconds, let me tell you that first, thank you for actually pushing us in this direction. I know it's been sometimes controversial. We brought everyone together, and what I see is really great results. We have actually reduced the use of seclusion restraints in Minnesota, nearly reduced the use of prone restraints. And what I see is everyone coming together, really looking at the data and using it to really create the change that we needed. And I think that's really wonderful. And it really tells the success of doing this. In 2014, you actually appropriated $250,000. Part of it went out to six districts to actually do some more intensive training. The department set aside some money to create online training modules, which I think is a great way to do it, and they focused actually on three subsets of students with disabilities who were using the highest rate of prone restraints. It was students with a combination of severe mental illnesses and developmental disabilities, including fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, students with severe aggressive self-injurious behaviors, and students with severe intellectual impairments and aggressive self-injurious behaviors. What we want to do under this bill is to keep us going, but first to set aside some money so that school districts can bring in experts for a particular child. So you're talking about children with very complex needs. No one's really sure what to do. You want to bring someone in to say, okay, here's what you can do with this particular student. And so we think that will be helpful in really helping those particular children. And then the second part is where schools are having a high use of seclusion restraints, not just prone restraints, which is what we focused on last time, but to allow some of the districts, including some of the intermediate districts who have really kind of figured some of this out, to help those schools as well. So this just brings us to the next step. Again, everyone is very supportive of this, and we really appreciate your support in this effort.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify in Senate File 1188? If not, Senator Torres-Ray, would like to make a motion for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I renew my motion that Senate File 1188 be considered for possible inclusion.
On that motion, all in favor indicate aye.
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 Opposed? Motion adopted. Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray, Ms. Eberholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And
thank you,
members, that includes business for today. We will meet tomorrow at 8:30. The agenda is published. And if you have any questions, comments you'd like to talk about hearings following break, let me know. And soon we'll be able to announce the timetable leading up to a adoption of our own omnibus E-12 finance bill. There being no further business, we're adjourned.